time for a weekly look at the top news in national politics. The U.S. Senate is getting ready for tomorrow's hearing with Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh and Christine Blasey Ford, who has accused him of sexual assault. And more allegations against Kavanaugh came out today. Plus, Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein's future is still uncertain, and this is all happening with midterm election campaigns in full swing. Astead Herndon is a national politics reporter for the New York Times. He's also a graduate, by the way, of Marquette University. Astead, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with the latest on Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh and the confirmation process. We have this hearing, as I mentioned, with Christine Blasey Ford, his first accuser. What do we know about how this hearing is going to work, Astead?
Yeah, we have a little bit of an idea of how this is going to go down. First, she would speak, and the actual members of the Judiciary Committee on the Republican side have retained a woman out of Arizona who works with special victims to do their questioning for them. They were very concerned about the optics of an all-male panel questioning Christine Blasey Ford, the Kavanaugh's accuser. So they have decided to kind of outsource that questioning, which is somewhat of a controversial decision. And so this is what we have now. It's going to be an interesting setup, these Republican senators having this woman question the woman bringing forth the allegations. And then after that, you'll have Judge Kavanaugh, who has presented his statement. But then we'll get questions from both the Democratic and Republican senators, who will be free to ask not only about the woman who presented the testimony in front of him, but also the other accusations which have come out since.
Right. We have today a third woman now making allegations about Kavanaugh's past behavior. Julie Swetnick gave a sworn statement that was released through the lawyer Michael Avenatti. What is in this statement?
This statement has some very provocative claims in it. She says there's a woman who is known, is a Washington, D.C. Government experience. She has security clearance. She lays that out. So someone who is presenting this statement with knowing the penalties of what could come if it is false. She has said that she knew Brett Kavanaugh in high school years, that they frequented similar parties, and that he was known to be a kind of loose drunk, a mean drunk that behaved in really vicious ways towards women. And she specifically calls out a couple instances in which she had seen Brett Kavanaugh and his best friend, Mark Judge, who's come up in some other statements, try to disrobe women or try to fondle women against their consent. And then the most provocative claim is she has seen them witnessed them be a part of a group of men who have tried to, in a row, have sex with a woman who was too inebriated to consent. And she says that she herself was one of those women one time, and that Brett Kavanaugh and Mark Judge were present at the time that she was sexually assaulted.
What has the reaction been, especially from the key people in this now, the U.S. Senate? What kind of reactions have we seen to these latest claims?
We've seen Democrats escalate their claims against Brett Kavanaugh. Chuck Schumer, the Democratic minority leader, said that he should resign. There should be a full FBI investigation. That's a little more than what he was calling for previously. What we have not seen is a real response from Republican senators just yet. It's unclear. We've seen some come out on Twitter, Senator Lindsey Graham, saying he has a hard time believing these accusations, saying what type of a person continues just to go to parties where they know people have been sexually assaulted at, trying to demean or smear the claims coming from this woman. But we have not seen a uniform response, especially from the key senators who hold this nomination in the balance. Senators like Lisa Murkowski in Alaska, senators like Susan Collins in Maine, those folks have yet to come out really with these claims. So we don't know exactly how they've played just yet.
And Michael Avenatti is the lawyer who's worked with Julie Swetnick. And you've been kind of watching for this, as you mentioned on Twitter, whether his involvement is getting more attention in some ways than the accusation itself.
Yeah, the president tweeted some claims against Michael Avenatti, saying he's a, quote, third-rate lawyer that is making up accusations against them. It's important to remember a couple things here. You know, no matter how much Michael Avenatti goes on television, it's not him making these claims. It's Julie Swetnick who's doing so under the penalty of perjury. And also, contrary to the president's statement and tweet, Michael Avenatti's and his relation and his work with Stormy Daniels actually did produce legal results. It was that case that saw Michael Cohen admit to campaign finance violations and other schemes that have now that's going to result in him going to prison. So we have kind of a dual thing here. One, the president's trying to distract from the root of the claims because there's this woman, not Michael Avenatti, bringing them. But even if we are looking at Michael Avenatti's past work, they have produced real results.
And the big question then is, are there enough Republican senators who might vote against Brett Kavanaugh if and when that comes to the full Senate? People are watching names like Susan Collins, Lisa Murkowski, and Jeff Flake. We don't know. Can't predict the future, but what are you watching for?
It'll be interesting to see tomorrow if there is a really seminal moment that comes from this hearing. Right now, we've had Susan Collins sound a little sympathetic to Brett Kavanaugh, and we've had Senator Murkowski sound a little skeptical. You would need kind of two of those folks to break, because as you remember, a tie could be broken by Vice President Mike Pence. And so you would need all the Democrats to hold, which looks more and more likely. Originally, it was looking like a question of whether some of those red state Democratic senators would actually endorse Judge Kavanaugh, but that's looking less likely. And now we need to look at those senators and see if something happens tomorrow that really breaks public opinion. Right now, these are kind of falling along partisan lines, but we've seen new polling today that says that even GOP women may have really soured on this nomination. I think if that happens, if that is encapsulated in a moment tomorrow where Brett Kavanaugh is unable to answer a question or comes off as callous, if we have something that is replayed over and over, that may force one of those key senators that you mentioned to actually step away from the nomination.
We're talking with Astead Herndon right now, national politics reporter at the New York Times, looking at some of the top news in national politics. We'll pick up the conversation, look at some of the other stories going on in just a few moments. Right now, we pick up our conversation with Astead Herndon, national politics reporter for the New York Times, looking at some of the top news out of Washington. Astead, the big story tomorrow is that hearing we've been talking about in the Senate on the Supreme Court confirmation. Oh, except for the other big story, Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein is supposed to meet with the president, apparently to talk about the future of his job after this, I don't know what exactly happened Monday morning, a rumor fest about him quitting, being fired, I don't know. So what do we know about what is and isn't going on tomorrow?
We don't know much. We know that there was some rumor / question whether Rod Rosenstein thought that he was going to be fired or whether he was going to resign or offered to resign to Chief of Staff John Kelly. The reporting from the New York Times says that Rosenstein knew that President Trump was perturbed by the news that came out last week that he may or may not have joked about wiretapping the president or invoking the 25th Amendment. And he was preparing to meet with the president and had gotten a feeling that the president may have wanted to fire him. And so then the rumors started to flow. What we do know is that Rod Rosenstein remains the deputy attorney general right now and remains the overseer of the Mueller probe that President Trump surely once shut down. What we don't know is if that will be true come Thursday afternoon. We will see what happens in this meeting, but there are some things that we know to be true. There is a wing of the Republican Party that is very vocal in its distaste for Rosenstein and Robert Mueller and has been asking President Trump to dismiss one, if not both of them, for months now. We know that that wing is not reflected by the Republican Party as a whole, that there are many Republicans who say that he should keep them in place. But we know that Mitch McConnell and others in Congress have refused to go along with legislation that would protect their jobs even over the president's change of mind. Which one of those factions ends up winning, that remains to be seen.
Right. We've seen a range of things in the House. As you mentioned, there is this wing of the Republican Party. There are members of the House who want to impeach Rod Rosenstein, others who want to subpoena him. Susan Collins, Republican Senator Susan Collins of Maine, says she would be worried. She would not be fond of any effort to fire Rosenstein. So there's a lot there. And It seems like this story could change a lot tomorrow, or we could come to Friday and nothing at all has changed.
Exactly. We could have a kind of stalemate here where President Trump knows that the blowback might be so much that he will just keep this deputy attorney general in place, even though all signs point to him being someone who the president's not the fondest of. But it also go the other way. No matter the pronouncements by people like Susan Collins and others, there has not been legislation to protect the deputy attorney general, and the only thing that is keeping him in his job is the president. And so we know that this is a president that changes his mind, one that goes back and forth about decisions. We also know this is a president that has not loved to fire people in person. And so all of these forces are kind of meeting each other in a way that has real big questions for our kind of democratic institutions and structures, but we don't know how it's going to play out.
And finally, all this drama this week is going on with the backdrop of the midterm election campaign getting closer and closer. We're seeing polls lately showing Democratic enthusiasm, preferences for Democrats in races for Congress. It's still early, still a lot of weeks to go, obviously, between now and the election. What are you watching for to gauge whether what we're seeing in the polls now carries over to Election Day?
Yeah, this is what, I'm on the midterms team at the Times. We've been watching this for a couple months now. And what we see here is in the last couple weeks, there has been some late-breaking movement that shows maybe the Democratic enthusiasm is even bigger than we sometimes expect it. We've seen Hispanic voters in key swing districts really break for Democrats in recent polls. We have to see if that holds. But if we have a kind of confluence of factors, if we see some of the suburban voters break against President Trump, if we see increased turnout from young people or minorities, that is what has the makings of the blue wave that people have been talking about. And so as we get closer and closer, some of those signs look more and more likely. But as we know from 2016, you got to wait till Election Day to find out.
Are you and your team there watching Midwestern states like us here in Wisconsin carefully?
Yes, we are. You know, some of the big swing districts are out there. You know, I've been out to Wisconsin, to Paul Ryan's old district, which is one that, you know, lots of folks are watching. And we're also watching the gubernatorial races. You know, Wisconsin and Scott Walker's reelection campaign is really top of mind. You know, the polling hasn't looked good for the Governor Walker there. But again, that's something that can change. And we know that he has fended off real serious challenges before. But those Midwestern states, you have a couple districts in Wisconsin, you have a couple districts in Minnesota, you have some in Ohio, my home state, Illinois, and I think that there are real places there that will be a real bellwether, or especially in states that may have went for President Trump in 2016, if we have seen some erosion of his support.
Ested, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Ested Herndon is a national politics reporter for the New York Times. He was with us for our weekly look at the top news out of Washington. The Affordable Care Act was signed into law more than 8 years ago now, but there are ongoing political fights over the best way to provide health care. Many conservatives are still opposed to Obamacare, and the idea of a Medicare for All system is becoming more mainstream among some liberals. But in the midst of all that back and forth, another model has turned up, one that's known as direct primary care. Scott Gordon is the associate editor of WisContext. He recently took a closer look at direct primary care, often called DPC for short. Scott, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, this idea will be new to a lot of people. What is this direct primary care?
So direct primary care is basically a business model for healthcare where you contract directly with a primary care doctor or practice and basically pay them kind of a monthly membership fee for access to their services rather than your primary care doctor billing your insurance company for each visit or each, you know, kind of treatment meted out.
And states are doing a lot of different things when it comes to regulating or not regulating this kind of service. First of all, what are we doing here in Wisconsin?
Well, right now in Wisconsin, we don't have any law on the books that that actually addresses direct primary care. The legislature took one up this spring, but it died in the Senate. And there's currently a legislative committee and study group that's looking into what the next step should be in kind of analyzing how we want to approach this on a policy level.
And you write that a lot of other states have passed legislation, so theoretically Wisconsin could look to them for models. But then the question is, which one? It looks like literally and figuratively, these regulations are all over the map.
Yes. And, you know, about 25 different states have either passed laws or seriously considered laws dealing with direct primary care. And they do vary quite a bit in their approach to regulation. And the other thing about them is, you know, the oldest of these laws has been around for maybe 10 or 12 years. So, you know, it really hasn't been around long enough for people to know which policy approaches get the best results over the long run. You know, one big thing that the direct primary care community kind of pushes for is for state laws to specify that direct primary care agreements are not health insurance. And the idea with that is that keeps direct primary care practices from being regulated by state-level insurance regulators. But there are, you know, widely varying rules as to, you know, what kinds of billing direct primary care doctors can do. Some states, though they're the minority, allow direct primary care doctors to actually bill insurance on top of that monthly fee. And, you know, some states have some pretty explicit rules on the books and give the state agencies specific powers to inspect and investigate and even in some cases shut down direct primary care practices. Others, like Wyoming, keep it really loose and simple. You know, Wyoming basically says direct primary care is not insurance, and essentially leaves it at that. Although, you know, in most cases, including their, you know, agreements have to state pretty clearly what it is and isn't as far as insurance goes.
Now, as you said, the newest laws are only about a decade old, and this is also a style of practice that hasn't been around. It isn't used that much, so there's a lot of gray area about whether it's helping patients, right? What do we know and not know?
Well, we really don't know that much because there hasn't been a whole lot of empirical research done about the kinds of health outcomes that DPC gets, you know, relative to more conventional insurance-driven primary care practices, you know, or the economic outcomes. You know, there's the argument that's made in favor of direct primary care is that this allows physicians to, you know, have more direct relationships with their patients and spend less time doing insurance paperwork, that they have more flexibility in, you know, what they can do with patients and when they can do it because they don't have to assign everything to an insurance code in order to bill the insurance company and so forth. They kind of see it as a way to innovate and to address some of the inefficiencies in the broader healthcare system.
And one question that might come up for people is, okay, great, lovely, I see my primary care doctor. I can go in whenever I want with this. But what if I need something extra? I need a surgery, a lab procedure that they don't do at this office. The list goes on and on. What happens then?
Right. And that's a really important question because, you know, all these different doctors and practices are certainly thinking about this, but they all vary in how they approach it. They all vary as to what they offer in-house. You know, I talked to a direct primary care doctor in Mequon who, you know, thinks that direct primary care doctors should be getting back into the business of things like OBGYN care and, you know, dermatology and other things that we don't typically think of now as what a primary care doctor does. One kind of emerging approach is to have this direct primary care agreement and then have, you know, a catastrophic so-called wraparound policy that covers the big stuff. And, you know, the argument that the direct primary care community is making is that using health insurance for your primary care isn't how it should go, and health insurance should be kind of reserved for these bigger, more catastrophic, more massively expensive healthcare things. I've had multiple people in that world sort of say, well, using your health insurance for a primary care doctor visit would be like using your car insurance to have your tires rotated or something like that.
Talking to Scott Gordon from WisContext about direct primary care, DPC, it's often called for short. It's a different model of providing health care, an alternative to insurance in some ways. I maybe should ask this up front, Scott. Do we have any idea how common this is?
Well, we know that it's catching on. It's not at necessarily a furious pace, but the definitely the idea has been gaining a lot more traction, and there are doctors and healthcare practices in Wisconsin doing this. It's still not clear exactly, you know, how much it's grown. Definitely not so much that it, you know, challenges the kind of prevailing healthcare paradigm we have, where things are, you know, revolve around insurance companies and in these larger healthcare delivery systems.
Now, with traditional, I guess we can call it, insurance and managed care, one of the big questions behind the Affordable Care Act, and since it was passed, is, okay, what about people with pre-existing conditions? They cost more for insurers. That's an economic incentive for them to either not take on people or charge more. Regulations limiting their power to do that. Okay, well, if I'm a direct a primary care physician, it's more economical for me to have that healthy patient who visits me twice a year than that patient with a chronic condition who might visit me twice a month. Is there any kind of regulation out there on that?
That's a good question, and I think it varies a bit from state to state. But, I mean, of course, when you declare in a law that direct primary care isn't insurance, then, you know, ostensibly that pre-existing condition protection doesn't necessarily apply. I think I'm sure there are varying views on this within that community. You know, for example, one lobbying group that I looked at in the DPC world has a model bill that actually says, you know, doctors shouldn't turn people away for medical reasons. And people studying this from a public health perspective have raised the issue that DPC will, you know, attract this more self-selecting population that is healthier and less diverse than the overall population. You know, DPC doctors have disputed that and kind of said, well, if these people were healthy, they wouldn't be seeking out our care and so forth. And so I'm not sure exactly how that's going to shake out in the long run. There's this just broader issue that it's hard to regulate something that isn't very standardized, where there isn't necessarily a typical version of it.
Is there a drive to have that standardized typical version and maybe make it work at a larger scale? You write that some, say, businesses might be interested in looking at this as a model that might be more cost effective for them.
Right. This is something that businesses have explored, you know, using a direct primary care agreement as part of their package of health benefits for employees. Again, they couldn't just offer that if they're, you know, a large enough employer that they're required to offer health coverage. But that's something that would probably drive more standardization, because especially if larger corporations start doing more of this, you know, they're going to want to know that they're getting kind of the same thing, or at least that they know what to expect across the board. And also there are efforts to get Medicare and Medicaid dollars involved in direct primary care. And that, I think, inevitably would drive some more standardization of the practices. Because there's lots of rules around, you know, how you're supposed to spend those dollars.
There's a lot of enthusiasm among supporters of direct primary care. Did you see, as you researched this, pushback from elsewhere in the medical community?
Yeah, there is quite a bit of skepticism about it. And, you know, even some of the skeptics say, look, you know, there's probably a place for this and it probably has something to offer. You know, there's concerns that the emerging sort of regulatory and legal framework will not give consumers enough protection, won't give consumers enough places to go and advocates if they do have a problem or complaint. You know, people advocating for DPC say, well, there's already things like medical licensure and existing consumer protection laws. You know, but again, we still are in kind of this gray territory where you're buying medical services, but you're also buying this somewhat novel product in the form of this agreement. And so there's concerns about, you know, how it will shape the overall healthcare system, you know, whether its effects are going to be equitable, and again, just how we're supposed to make the case factually about the overall impact of this care model.
This is one part of this huge and ongoing debate over our really complicated healthcare medical system, our insurance system. Is this something that you think is going to keep coming up as an issue here in Wisconsin in the next couple of years, maybe in the legislature?
Yeah, I think so, absolutely, because you know, there are people pushing for this. There's definitely an aspect, a political aspect of the direct primary care movement. Not the whole movement, but certainly some of the more vocal elements in it have this very kind of libertarian to right-wing bent. So, you know, if we continue to have a conservative-dominated legislature, that, I think, will inevitably have an effect on the kinds of policies that get made. And, you know, however you look at it politically, there are lots of people who are interested in coming up with genuine solutions and trying new things. And I think just about everyone agrees that the, prevailing system that we have of healthcare doesn't work very well for everybody or for most people. So there's definitely an openness to exploring solutions, and there's, some work going on again at the state policy level to try and figure out where Wisconsin should go with this.
We'll watch for that. Scott, thanks again for joining us.
Thanks very much, Rob.
That was Scott Gordon, associate editor of WisContacts, talking about a new model of healthcare called direct primary care. You can find his article about it online at wisContacts.org.